Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, your weekly dose of Porsche culture. With Tech Talk, Heritage, the Ren Builds playlists, along with a massive dollop of waffle, we'll keep you entertained. So subscribe now on any podcast streaming service and YouTube. So thank you and welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. In this episode, we've got Rightune and Chris from Rightune. Big Chris. I look like a pygmy next to the guy. He's massive. But he's also really, really knowledgeable about air-cooled Porsche engines. He builds them for a living. His dad built them for a living. So I managed to sit down with Chris, particularly when it comes to the Ren 550. So to remind you, the Ren 550 is a Lotus chassis and a Elise chassis, the carbon fiber 550 spider body and an air-cooled Porsche engine in the back. That's going to be built. Rightune are going to help me make that happen, but I needed to sit down with Chris and figure out which of all of the different air-cooled engines are the right ones, which are the ones you want to avoid. I don't know. I genuinely don't know. So I said to Chris, can I come down and sit down with you, mate? We'll go through all of this stuff and try and figure out what the right thing to do is. He said, yes, come down. We'll do that, no problem. And I will give him a shout out because in the last couple of weeks, as I've been getting close to buying a donor car for the Ren 550, I found a VX220 that looked like it was going to be the one, the perfect car for that donor. Sadly, it fell through, but I've been absolutely on it, Chris. Like, how do I need to start 3D scanning stuff? I need to make sure that I can make mock-ups and I can put things into CAD and SolidWorks, all that sort of stuff to try and figure out how we're going to shoehorn that engine in the back of a Lotus-derived chassis for the first time ever. Chris has been amazing and said, yeah, no problem at all, let's do that. So he, off the back of kind of lots of WhatsApps and things like that, he's been trying to help me figure that stuff out as well, and is happily going to donate something to for me to start scanning and mocking up and getting into CAD. So all very cool, but yeah, let's sit down for the next hour and you can see me and Chris talking about air-cooled engines in general, what Rightune do and how they can help make the Ren 550 happen. Hope you enjoy and I'll see you back at the end. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. And if you've watched the intro, you'll know that I'm a Rightune. I'm with Chris, right? Hello, yes. Chris.
Hello.
Hello. So this conversation is about Rightune and their background, but it's also about a tech talk and a heritage episode teaching me about air-cooled engines, because I know the amount you could write on a postage stamp about air-cooled engines, and this man and his father, you might have just seen a bit of B-roll flowing around as well. Know a lot more than I do. So Chris, before we get into the company and all the work you do and teaching me about air-cooled stuff, I'll talk about you a little bit first, if that's all right.
Yes,
fine. So,
What do I want to know?
You're telling me only once.
Yeah.
Take me back to you as a youth. This format's generally the same across all of these, right? So you are a 5-6-year-old kid. Where did cars come from, mate? Where's the inspiration or the kind of passion for all of this come from?
It's probably like two things. Obviously my dad working on Porsches back in the day, as well as race cars and stuff in the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him taking me out in one particular car, which was a 3.3 turbo, just on the road up, which he probably drove in on, and we were doing sort of 140, and I thought it was fantastic.
Wow. How old were you then?
Young.
I mean, just to be clear, this is like a long time ago when the road, the speed limits were very different then. Yeah.
It was a special road that wasn't a public road. So that was, that made me think, oh, I quite like this.
Mm.
And then also, when I got to about nine, I said I want to go and race motocross.
Wow, right, okay.
So I was never like pushed into it, and so we went and looked. There's a track relatively near to here called Cullum, which they use for the British, and we went there, and he's like, I don't think your mum's going to be too happy with this.
Or broken arms and legs everywhere, yeah.
Every single race is someone in the ambulance. We went and spoke to like a champion, and he was like
16 with a spinal plate and loads of fused
bones.
Yeah,
his dad was like, yeah, no, he's never been injured, he's fine. And he's like, yeah, what about when I punctured my lung and did this? And then also at that time in the like mid 90s, you couldn't rent like a motocross bike or anything, so you just had to like go full out buying stuff. It's quite a lot of money just for a normal family to do back then. And you could go and rent a go-kart and go out for the day. So we went to like Rye House in Hoddesdon, rented a car, went out for the day. And then, yeah, then that was it really. So then we were racing karts. We got into doing that quite seriously, did sort of British Championship, did that until sort of 15.
You're a big guy though, mate. So when did you have your growth spurt?
It was a disadvantage, yeah, it was a problem. Not the weight. Now I'm older, I am a bit fat, but I used to be like a like a stick, but yeah, my head was always like one helmet higher than Then ran out of money basically, it got very expensive. Then a bit later on we started doing karts. So when I was old enough to drive, my dad had the business but he just started it, and it's in this estate just across the way, and only had one ramp. He said, well, if you help me build this kart, I'll help you race it. So we bought an Alfa Romeo, because I don't know why, but we did.
Which Alfa Romeo?
33.
So it's a boxer. Oh yeah, cool. Engine, not a clover leaf.
One of our customers did it, and it was like relatively cheap motorsport, although there was no such thing. So did that, then moved to Ginetta, and then the year after that we got an opportunity to race an old, it was at the time, a 4-year-old GT3 Cup car. So we did that car, that was really good.
That's a big step up, isn't it?
It was, yeah, but we did quite well and it was good fun. And it was a like multi-driver thing. So we raced that with the Maserati brothers, Miles and Piers Maserati. Piers did quite well with sports cars, and his dad back in the day, Jamie Maserati, they're sort of from Pinner in London. They're a great family, Porsche like nuts. And we raced it with them. It was really good fun, and we raced that. But then that was sort of the year of the credit crunch. 2008.
Okay.
And after that, it all got a bit too much, so we stopped. And then.
So before we get too far into it, this company was. Your dad started it?
Yeah, dad started it after. So he's had a long history working with Porsche, but for specialist Ferrari and Lamborghini as well, he worked on.
Named Right Tune all the way back, or was it named something else?
No. This was, he was working at main dealers and race teams.
Fine, okay, right.
Worked for John Moir Automotive in Slough when they ran like the Golf Mirage cars, the GR8, and they had DFE engines. So dad used to also build DFEs. And they won them. So my dad, I think when he was like 23, built the engine that won Le Mans for Ix and Bell.
Yeah. Genuinely. He's back in the shop. If you can hear some kind of noises and stuff, he's rustling. In the back, and fair play to him.
He's really good with engines. So yeah, did that. And he did that. And then worked for other people. Then the longest sort of period, he worked for G-Force Motorsport in the 80s and 90s. It was worked with John Greasley. He had a race team called Dage Sport, then became G-Force. The Blue Coral cars, they're relatively like well known now from that era, but work on predominantly doing the engines for, well, they had 935s, GT1s, GT2s, GT3s, 934s, other turbo things. Yeah, they raced, did British GT, predominantly an FIA GT, and they're quite successful. So,
and then... So you've been exposed to it like the whole way through your life. This isn't something... You didn't like decide to be an apprentice mechanic in like, the 90s or early 2000s. You were born into this world, right?
Yeah.
You were never getting away.
No. But the thing is now you look back and think, that's mental. I'd come home from school and dad would be in between a race and he'd have to drive the van home with the car on the back and there'd be a GT2 on the driveway and I'd just be like climbing all over it.
You just don't know any better, right? Yeah.
It was just like round the corner now.
But this is the wild thing is that you go to, and I think there's an element of this happens even now, you go to a show or something and you see loads of these things knocking around and then you get almost a bit snowblind from it. You don't feel the specialness, but you see one of them on their own and then you're like, oh my fucking God. And you're there for like 2 hours looking at the thing.
Special cars now, and it is a shame, I think, that you don't see them and people do wrap them up because they're so, because of the value, I guess. You don't see them as much, do you? You do go, when you see one. Unless you go to one of these shows like in Essen or wherever,
Francisco
or somewhere like that. You don't see them very much and it would be much more fun.
So tell me about your entry into spannering then? Like, were you, like, was it your dad taught you everything?
Yeah.
Was it that?
Yeah, well, basically, yeah, doing the karting. And then when I got, I wasn't going to do this kind of career at all. I was into design. I did a degree in illustration. I used to work in the record industry designing album covers.
Wow.
Completely different. But at the same time, I was also interested in doing this, and I really badly wanted to get back involved with motor racing, and I needed money. So I was working, doing other things as well as doing artwork. I was working any job I could just to pay. I think I used to blow my whole paycheck every month just like on the one race, and then struggling. So I wanted to get back into karting again because they had a class for like heavier or taller people. So that was, really, to be honest, the passion for it came later. Initially, it was like, I just started to work with my dad. He said, yeah, we'll come and work here a bit. And so I could buy tyres or something for my go-kart.
Of course, yeah.
And then the hunger to like do that, and then it all comes hand in hand. And then I was like, I think I'm going to give up doing the art stuff and focus on this because I actually find it's a lot more interesting.
But to be fair, though, there's an element, especially if you're designing stuff or building stuff.
Well, I think things like this is engineering and art.
It is. It? That's so, my point, right? Yeah.
And and not just with this, the modern stuff as well. It all comes from this. But yeah, it's like I've said this a few times, but there is a sculptor called Theo Jansen who used to do they use BMWs in on adverts, and he's a kinetic sculptor. He makes like creatures that move on the beach and they're wind powered. And he says the difference between art and engineering exists only in our minds. And I think a lot of people who are involved in this sometimes have an artistic background.
For sure.
Look, let's face it, it's not normal, is it? It's a boxer air-cooled engine.
Yeah.
That is quite unique.
Yeah.
There's not much else like this. So I think everyone involved in this is often slightly eccentric, even if they don't think they are.
Yeah. They're cool eccentric rather than... They've got like six TVRs, a Rover P6 and like that kind of eccentric.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing wrong with TVRs, by the way. They're fine. But yeah, but it's true though. You've got to be properly passionate about the brand. It's one of the few brands that you get people that are, I think Mini's probably like that. And if you go to the States, you get like, you get your GM guys and your Ford guys and all that stuff. But,
but
Porsche is like universal all around the world and everyone's about the same level of nerdiness.
Yeah, I think so. I like that. We did a show last year and an Australian guy was working with a friend of mine who works at Williams. He said, oh, I don't understand you lot. In Australia, I have to have my Ford coat on.
You got to display who you are.
Like a Holden, and then he's like, and then we hate each other. You guys, you should be advertising. And I'm like, I'm not going to wear like Porsche. Just calm down. It's fine. We're all friends.
It's like a Jerry and Friends scene.
Maybe some of those guys drink a lot of beers and have a ruck then
at
the super. Is it super? What do they call it? Super. What's those V8 supercars, isn't it?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Your Bathurst stuff.
All that stuff. It's great.
Amazing. So, we've done a bit of you. This is where I need to learn Kung Fu. So, think like, teach me everything, right? It's one of those. So, because I really am...
Teach you everything in 30 minutes.
In 30 minutes.
It's this simple.
Take me on a history tour, mate, if you can.
What have I got myself involved with? History of what? The engines?
The engines. So, where start with... the earliest level of not, the earliest.
We don't work pre, 64, 65.
Fine.
901. We don't.
That's
do,
where you. That's where you live, right?
We don't do like the 356 or 4-cylinder stuff.
Fine.
At the moment. Maybe one day.
Right.
But yeah, this is like an early 2-liter engine, and the crankcase is different. You can't see this on the camera, but it's.
We'll get some B-roll.
It's sand cast, and. It's very, very heavy, but really, really good quality.
Okay.
And then after this, they move to the one like behind you, which is it's a magnesium crankcase and lots of magnesium parts like the chain case, housings, the breather cover, these covers, the covers on the cam covers will be. And Porsche actually won a lot of designs for this, for engineering, because I don't know the exact reason because I've not got a thesaurus of a brain, but it is true. They won some design awards, and it's from this to this, the weight difference is massive.
Okay.
And they're really, really light. That is like an anchor.
Okay.
And these are very, very light. And then after that.
So era, so talk to me about years. When was this in production? From 65 to?
I think, yeah, technically the first Porsche is 64, but really it's 65, isn't it? And then this is all off the top of my head and I'm very bad with dates.
Stick in the comments if he's massively out by these dates, by the way.
Give me a thrashing. I deserve it. So 64, 65 to 68, like this crankcase. Mm-hmm. Then 69, they did some 2 litre still, but with magnesium.
Okay,
so they went to magnesium crankcase in 69. And then that went, and then so like the 2.7 RS has a magnesium crankcase.
Yeah, yeah. That's what they started remanufacturing, right? They've started building short blocks you can buy directly.
You can buy the magnesium crankcases again from Porsche, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then in, oh, I think, so they did 3 litre, I think some of the 3 litre Carrera 3 magnesium crankcase, and then SC, they then went to aluminium.
Right.
Had a sump plate like this, and then when it goes to 3.2 Carrera, they close that up and there's like a bung on the side.
Okay.
So they went to that. Then the 964, they changed the crankcase, then they never went back to magnesium crankcases.
It's probably production costs. That. It's harder to work with magnesium than it is aluminium.
They're a nightmare, to be honest, to work with these magnesium crankcases. They're a lot more, when you rebuild them, a lot more engineering has to go in. And also, I think they probably didn't think somebody 50 years later is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they also suffer a lot from corrosion, so sometimes they're destroyed. They warp.
They're porous when they age.
Some of them are just, they will just leak oil because they've gone porous. You have to throw them away, but you see what I mean? It's not going to work. 964, they changed it slightly again. It was still aluminium. 993, and then obviously we're on to the water cooled. So, but essentially, they're all very similar. With lots of very, they have obviously made lots of revisions.
And of course, yeah.
Things, but.
How much of it's interchangeable when you sort of like move through the generations? Is it possible to build like a cherry pick the best of everything, you know, and kind of it all relatively assembles together?
You've got different like size barrels. Mm-hmm. So obviously you can't get like a 993 barrel and put it in this unless you machine it.
Yeah.
Crankcase.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's more or less, it's very interchangeable. The early cam carriers. So yeah, well, both of these will be the same. They're both. I shouldn't have got up. I've gone out.
Sorry, right. He's gone out of shot. Well, this
true, fine. True professional. They're three bearing, and then they go to four bearing cam carriers. The head's got bigger, like the intake, the valves got bigger. Basically, they just gradually got bigger.
Okay.
But. Not really. I mean, these gears, they're the same on this.
Are they?
As they would be, you know, on the very late air cooled stuff.
Wow, okay. What sort of performance figures are we looking at from the kind of 65 stuff all the way through to, are there massive steps up? Obviously, you're going to have steps up in displacement and forward stroke. It's going to make a difference.
They started off like a 2 litre. I think if you read the spec book, in the day it was about 130 horsepower.
Yeah. Okay.
And they did gradually go up. 2.7 RS is 210.
Mm-hmm.
Then they took a bit of a step back when they went to like K jet, like 2.7 K jet.
Yeah.
They were pretty crap.
Like 150, 160 cats horsepower. That you could they start putting catalytic converters on them.
Yeah, and also it depends on where you are.
Okay.
So we got better engines than, like, for example, they've got in America, because I think it's also because of the fuel.
Californian
emissions
stuff. So they
have lower horsepower stuff.
Yeah.
The SC, obviously, they had, like, revision, wasn't it? Like, 180, 188, 201 or 202, I think. And then 3.2 Carrera's 231.
Mm-hmm.
But Porsche also underestimate their horsepower.
Yeah.
They're very, not kind to themselves on that. But I would suspect that they were slightly higher.
Right, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
964 is about 260 horsepower, I think. 993, a tiny bit more. It's not, they're not big horsepower, but then, and then you've got turbo, which is another kettle of fish. But, so I think, yeah, that's like a 3 litre turbo. I think the standard car, like non-turbo, was like 160, 170.
And right.
It's like 270, so it's 100 more horsepower with
the
same brakes.
Yeah. As I say, but just off camera about 25 minutes ago, we were talking about this car. So I know a bit more about this, but tell the audience. So this is a really early
turbo,
right?
Well, the first turbo was 75, so that's 76, but it's still quite rare. You don't see many of them around. There's no intercooler, but essentially the Porsche was like, obviously nowadays, lots of cars are turbo, aren't they?
Everything's turbo.
More or less. But this was like, they were one of the forefront, of companies. Mm. And you've got to remember as well, a really small company, not like they are now, very small company. And they were doing, they started doing turbocharging, and obviously it also gave them a lot of success in motorsport.
Mm.
But yeah, basically, cut a long story short.
This is a 76.
76 turbo. It's very rare. And then it's got, it goes like, even by today's standards, it goes
still
like
a fast car,
but you can't stop it because the brakes are the same as the 2.7 like non-turbo car. So yeah, a little bit interesting. But it's also like, it's like your perception. I think it's like a lot of driving is like your perception of speed, isn't it?
Mm.
And honestly, some of these early cars, you drive them and they're fantastic. And you feel, I feel, to me anyway, it feels like you're going faster. Whereas you could get in something modern and you can do like 150 and you could
And it doesn't
feel like a lot's happening, whereas the
perception,
it's not just that, it's your feeling through your bum, through what you feel on the steering wheel, the sound, the smell.
Yeah.
It's
even things like, so if you think about this stuff, right? I mean, when I was at Rensport 2-3 weeks ago, they threw me the keys to one of their cars and then one of their donor cars. And one of the things I found was like the glass is like right in your face. Like think about... And then you get in like modern cars now, right? And you're so insulated from everything, right? So, but the sound deadening is basically non-existent. You shut a door on one of these and you get dunk, whereas you shut a door on any modern car and it closes like the old Golf GTI ad, right? So all of that cocoons you away from experience what speed is. So now you get into, and when I was at the Ring last week, there's a guy that bumped into a guy that had an E-Class E63 AMG, had done 210 mile per hour on the Autobahn. Like, it boggles my mind that you can jump in a car, it wasn't a new car, and you just go out and do 210 miles. And he was talking about it as if he went to the shops. But you go in these things and they're genuinely quick still. It's just that what's happened over the years, in my opinion anyway, is we've shifted what fast is.
Yeah.
And we're so cocooned from the speed that actually if you to take... one of these at 210 mile an hour, your bum would be tweaking all over the place.
So you'd need some toilet roll, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It would be.
But these are still quick.
They are, yeah. That's really fast.
Yeah,
It genuinely is. It's really fast. And it is quite fun as well, going out in these early cars and giving some modern stuff a run for its money. They're shocked and driving them how they should be. But, we've got a couple... me and my father, and you overtake people and geek out and they're like, what's going on here?
So on that, let's talk a bit about your dad's car, because that's the one that's up on the ramp. I'll get some B-roll for so you'll be able to see that now. It's a beautiful car, mate. And we did talk about it a little bit off camera, but I was trying my best not to take too much in. So if you give me a potted history of that car as well, that'd be great.
He bought that like 15 years ago with a ruined engine when they weren't worth very much. And then... rebuilt the engine, rebuilt the gearbox. Then one day, took the sill off, just like to put a new, I can't remember, just doing some maintenance. And, oh dear, there's a hole. So it had inner and outer sills. Mm. And then it stayed nice. He had the front seats retrimmed. The interior was all original. And it's still 160,000 miles, but it's still really, really nice. But then, last year I got a bit carried away because I want to do some shows and also like as a bit of a present for Dad. So I thought, let's go like proper. And so the engine's only done like a few thousand miles since it's rebuilt, but it was just a little bit tarnished, although it was all detailed on top. So we did all the ancillaries, made that all look fresh. Then took the suspension off because I thought, well, if you look through the wheels, I'm not going to be that happy. Well, I can't just do the calipers because I'm a bit anal. So we ended up stripping all the suspension off, refurbishing all of that mechanically and aesthetically. Then I wanted a few like rust bubbles cleaned up. And then the painter we use is similar to us. And he's like, well, really, you know, it could do with some wings. And so we ended up having the car repainted. So... yeah, but I just wanted it to be like perfect.
Yeah.
And but stock.
Yeah,
so it's
all standard. So the engine's totally standard, right? When you rebuild
Well, not quite. Not quite. It is, but it's like done to club sport spec.
Fine.
To club sport, but the only difference is that really with the engine is hollow inlet valves and then a slightly higher rev range.
Fine.
Really, it's not very much.
Yeah. So what does that give you? You've upgraded.
It doesn't. Well, I don't think
it drives any
different. More horsepower. Just make it a little bit more responsive. I think.
Fine.
It may give it a tiny bit, but.
But not noticeably.
Not in reality, no. But you could get more horsepower. Like if you change exhaust, if you put like SSIs or something on it, that would give you a little bit more. But then.
Then it's noisy and actually.
It makes. Climb up the engine bay so the heater actually works. It makes the engine bay messy because you have to put pipes everywhere. Unless you just don't, but then the heater doesn't work very well. And then it makes it noisy. So it's just standard. I don't want to mess around with it too much. Just keep it because a lot of these cars are getting chopped up.
Yeah.
So it's nice to keep that.
Yeah.
Although there are a lot of
There are, but you know, like as time goes on, mate, we've talked about this off camera as well. It's really hard to keep these maintained. That you can get a rolling maintained car, right? There's always going to have a niggle. There's always going to be a pool of oil underneath it. But actually, to keep it to this standard, it's hard. Yeah. Like this, and there aren't that many of these. You know, there's loads of G bodies around, but there's not that many in like this condition.
Yeah, because it's not really worth it.
Yeah,
perhaps at the moment, but it will be. Soon, I should imagine.
I think it's probably about there now, but it's a stunning car, mate, and you can enjoy it and rely on it.
We do, and we enjoy it. We drive it. We're not like scared of it. Mm. But you know, he was going to drive it back yesterday in monsoon conditions, and the only reason I didn't is because I was like, I'm going to have to spend 10 minutes
drive,
and I'm going to have to spend 3 hours cleaning it underneath on top. I just couldn't be bothered more, but I wasn't worried about it.
Yeah,
I'm not worried about getting it wet. And so that's that really. That's sort of really that project finished, really. And it's,
Let's move on to your car then. Yeah. So you talk to me about your car, the history of that. Where did you buy it from? How did it end up?
Yeah, so that was like...
Because that's pretty trick as well, right? It looks it.
We've done a few bits, but like easily reversible, which I'll get onto in a minute. But yeah, the car, it's relatively interesting. So basically, an old go-karting rival used to has a business where he moves people from the French Riviera to back to England or over there. And he had a customer who was like, well, he's getting out of France. And I was surprised at the time they called me because we were crashing into each other every weekend. He said, well, I've got this customer and he's got this car in France and the engine's not in it and it's in a million bits.
Mm.
Can you help him? And I was like, yeah. He said, I'll bring it around your workshop. And when you take on projects like this, it's always like, oh, you're tempted to go, no. Because when they say, it's all there in a box.
It's never all there.
And it just turns usually into a bit of a nightmare. But we've done lots of projects like that. And unbelievably, it was all there. But basically, I think this, it went to a French body shop. They said the head gasket had gone. Well, they didn't have head gaskets. So we think that they overfilled it with oil, took it out, took the heads off, then thought, what have we done? And then it just stayed there, but for years. And then you know, like in body shops, some body shops are very clean tidy, but like the real shitty ones, there's like all the grinding paint, like the dust and stuff, and everything's like this, like an inch thick.
Yeah,
all of that had got all in the engine.
Oh shit!
So it wasn't just like put it back together.
No,
strip it, debung it, clean out all the oil ways, make sure. that there's no, because if this ship goes round, it could either A, block the oil system,
yeah,
or at like grinding pace.
Yeah, so, yeah, you get 10,000 miles and the engines are right off. Yeah.
So it, we stripped and rebuilt it properly. And a few other little jobs, and the client had about, this was like 2018, 2019. Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago then.
No, not really. And then last year, he emailed me saying, it's just been in storage, I don't really use it. I'm thinking about selling it. Do you know anyone who'd like to buy it? And I went, me.
Hands goes straight away.
Because I was like, you know, and I've been trying to buy one.
And you
one.
Knew that car, right then?
Yeah. It was a good car. And I've been looking for one to buy for a while because I want to, for our business, I want to restore. And we do a lot of restoration stuff. But I want to, and we do a lot as well for the trade, which people don't know about, but that's like confidential. But we do a lot for other specialists. But I want to move. One of the things I want to do is I want to do some more special projects, restorations, and like tuning. So what better way than to obviously do my own car?
Absolutely.
So I was looking for a good donor car for a while, and initially I was looking for like a shed, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But everyone wanted, who has a shed, thinks it's worth more than it is. And I was like, well, if I've got to put a floor in it or something,
yeah,
you know, we don't do the metal here, but we do take care of it. It's good, but the parts and, you know, everything. So I thought, it's actually like...
And it was a solid shell,
solid,
right?
Car. It's a solid car, yeah. So I thought, well, for a little bit more, it's more cost effective to buy one that's solid to begin with. So that I just say, yeah, I bought a good one. And then we brought it in, and I thought, well, it's too late to start now, because it was sort of like back end of last year. We had a lot on in the workshop, because obviously I can't just play with my toys every day.
Yeah.
We have to run a business.
Yeah.
So, it got to, okay, so I said to one of the lads, Joe, I said, well, just lower it, but not so low that you can't actually drive it.
Yeah.
And you get bump steer with 911s if you lower them too much.
Mm.
And make it look sit right. I want black wheels. No, a lot of people don't like black wheels. I do. So I was just like, yeah. So black wheels, lowered it, yellow lights.
Black Fuchs, right?
Yeah, they're just the standard wheels, but just sat in black.
Yeah.
Delete the rear wiper. So you can get a side silencer delete, which we did. Slightly louder, but not really that much. I think that's more or less it at the moment. And
you got plans for it going
forward? Yeah. So I was going to try and get ready for this year, but I haven't done it yet. I got some different camshafts. I bought like the fiber. I want it to make the engine look more like a period race engine. So I bought the fiberglass tinware, and I bought, like I was just saying, I wouldn't do to this, but some SSI heat exchangers, a twin outlet exhaust, so we'll have to model. But I don't want to, I am going to do a full nut and bolt rebuild on the car, restoration, but I'm not going to backdate it. I think, I really like G model, it's come, it's my era, like from a kid, and I think the backdating is done a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I really like the impact bump, but I'm not going to leave it standard. I'm with a few like tweaks, but like subtle, but I'm not really sure what I'm going to do with the engine. I'm not sure whether I turbocharge it, supercharge it, or put on throttle bodies, but
they're all very different, right?
I know, I can't make my mind up, it's a problem, but whatever it will be, it will be like, it won't be like a standard 3D curve, but it'll be quite radical. But at the same time, I don't want it to be, oh, it's great, got this great horsepower figure, but it's like undrivable on the road.
Yeah,
it's a road car at the end of the day. If you want to make it fast, you can, but it'd be unpleasant to drive on the road. Race cars are horrible.
It's weird. Like, I think there was, like, again, I think we're getting to the point now in, I don't know, maybe it's the age group of people, I don't know, you guys tell me, but, well, I don't know if it's that, but the attitude towards trying to extract every last bit of performance out of an engine seems to have shifted, and people are more like, yeah, but, you know, I'd rather dial it down a little bit, but have more mid-range, and actually, because that's what you use, rather than just have a stupid horsepower figure that is like, is meaningless because you're not racing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd like to put the, we've done the AC conversion from classic retrofit, we've done that on a few. I'd want that because Yeah, great, but in 30 degree heat in the summer,
it's pretty miserable,
it's
right?
Painful, yeah. Yeah.
So, especially if you're doing a road trip into the South France or something.
It's brilliant for like 10 minutes, but after, like if I drive to Le Mans or something, I'll be like, when I get there, I'll be like,
everyone else is getting out there like 901s and they're just all ready to go, and you're like,
yeah, I want to drive to, so I might actually have to do this before, but I want to drive to Copenhagen later in the year and go to the Lift Show.
Mm.
The same thing, I should imagine it's going to be hot.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Nice. So that's anything visual? Suspension? Anything like that's going to be done?
Oh,
or are you pretty happy with
I
that?
We did change the like dampers to like some Club Sport dampers because the old ones on it were like shot. That's the thing with a lot of these older cars. Some of them have been restored really nicely, and like literally people just like spray the shock absorber. It's like, yeah, but it's like 40 years old.
Yeah.
You get in the car, it's
just pinging down the road. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So just something, doing something simple like that and changing some bushes can like really transform it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we'll go out in a bit, but it drives well. It drives well. Yeah, it's got the slightly smaller steering wheel. I think it's called a Prototipo. I got asked that the other day. I didn't know.
I looked in it. It's a Prototipo, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, but yeah, I got it from Porsche. I just gave them a part number. But yeah, so it's that, which is better for me. I really need to change this. For me, being tall, the earlier 3-2 Carreras have a higher seating position, so the rail is actually higher.
Right,
and that's even worse because it's got higher. It's got a bigger bolt, like bigger seat. So I'm sort of sat like this. So that will be another modification I'll do for me. But having the slightly smaller wheel is better, obviously, just because
of course. Like, and there's no adjustment in those things, right? It's just
not
a fixed steering wheel.
You can move the chair back, seat backwards and forwards. But other than that, it's not. A lot.
It's pretty. Awkward.
But a lot of people think the foot position's funny, but I don't know. Maybe just because I've been brought up with it.
I think that's it, right? Because I jumped in one, like I said, a couple of weeks back, and I was heel and toe. I felt the pedal offset was really weird, and I don't know if it was just what I was driving, but to modulate brake pressure and get the side of your foot over to be able to heel and toe, I just couldn't do it properly. But then if you've driven something for ages, right, you get used to it and you know exactly where everything is.
Yeah, I mean, also with Porsche, I think compared to other brands, they've got they always have less like servo assistance. It's always a hard pedal.
Mm.
Even with the later cars, sometimes we get a customer come in with like a 997, 996 or a 991. I think I've got a problem with my brakes.
Mm. You've just got to hit it.
Hard.
So that's actually a really good, nice little segue. So right tune now, what do you guys work on? What's area of expertise and your kind of broad spread stuff that you work on? What services do the company offer?
It does sound a bit like, Jack of all trades, master.
Jack of all trades, master and none is...
Jack of all trades, master and none. But we do every Porsche apart from the 356 and 912 engines.
Okay.
So we do all the air cooled cars.
Yeah.
That's like my dad's expertise.
Yeah.
That's where he cut his teeth, do a lot of them. But it is like, because some people say, oh, we think you're just like a classic specialist. We're not. We do all the modern cars. We do a lot of the water cooled 996, 997, 991s. We haven't had many 992s in yet. Most of them are in. Like
still warranty, still on there,
But we also do the Macans, the KNs, Panameras, and myself and one of the other technicians, Mike, have just done like our EV hybrid training.
Mm.
So, and I understand that people are struggling to get independents to look at their Taycans. So, basically, we're going to very soon be doing them as well.
Mm.
Yeah, 928s we do, although they are difficult. But that's often also because of part supply.
Mm.
And 924, 944.
All the transaxle stuff, yeah.
Yeah, 968. Basically, more or less everything.
Mm.
It's just, we just don't do many. We don't do the 3-4. We have done 356 and 912s. We did so little of them, I felt that, you know what you know. And
yeah.
Your experience. So our experience of the model is not high.
Mm.
So if somebody comes and works for us one day, that's great experience, and I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
It's just I don't feel like we know enough about them to say I am a specialist at
this. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the reason. I like to do a very good job rather than just take people's money.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if you do a good job, then the business will run itself.
Hey, I hope you're really enjoying this episode. And if you are enjoying this episode, I have a very small request to make. I'm really trying to grow the YouTube channel at the moment. And whilst it's always nice when people naturally gravitate towards it and subscribe and like and share, I'm going to actually ask you, if you're enjoying this episode and you've enjoyed the Rengineering podcast so far, to head over to YouTube and subscribe. And yeah, let me know what you think of any of those episodes and if there's anything you'd like to see in the future. But for now, I'll head back to the episode, but just that small request. Thanks, take care.
Sometimes people think, oh, you're more of a classic specialist. We're not. We probably have more cars in the yard that are and we're working at any one time that are water cool. We do 906, 907, 901. Don't do many 992s because I think a lot of them will still be in warranty in the dealer network. And we do general maintenance, a lot of service work. And then these 996s and 997s now, people still using them a lot, but they're quite tired. 996.
Any car of that age, right? Yeah, would be that
20
way.
20 odd years old, so they're suffering from corrosion. So we're doing lots of like, we do like full suspension. We can do set up all the geometry properly. We don't. The other thing we don't do is we don't rebuild 996 onwards engines and gearboxes anymore. We have done. We don't do it at the moment. And we do the Cayenne, the Macan, the Panameras. Myself and another technician have just, Mike, we've just done our EV hybrid training. So we will be doing Taycans very shortly. In fact, I'm just waiting for a call from my insurance company to make sure that we're good to go.
Okay,
otherwise, we've got no problem with doing it. So I had a call the other day from someone who said, apart from the dealers, obviously Porsche main dealer is struggling to get anybody to work on them, so I don't see any reason why not.
And let's face it, right, as time goes on, it's going to be, there's going to be more of that, and kind of these will be even 996s, 997s will become more specialist, less used, and the bulk of the kind of daily stuff was going to be Taycans and Panamera hybrids.
We can't
and,
like, repair the batteries but we will be training to do that as well. So yeah, I mean,
tons.
I want to be able to do the Porsche range.
Mm.
There's like obviously specialist jobs that I won't do. I wouldn't say we wouldn't start retrimming the car.
Yeah.
You know?
We're
not going to start painting them either.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. Anything mechanical on a Porsche, basically.
You're in.
Yeah.
Nice. So
that's the wrong way. We're not up for it. We are capable.
Yes.
We will do it.
Good. So I want to take us to sort of round it off a little bit. I've talked to you about the Ren 550 project before. We know it's an elite. So for you guys, if this is the first time you're watching this, please go back and watch the teaser trailer and the full breakdown of what the Ren 550 is. That gives you a really good introduction to it. Essentially, Lotus Elise 111 chassis, carbon fiber, 550 spider body on top with an air-cooled engine in the back. Exactly. Custom subframe, start from scratch. There's a lot of work to do, a lot of engineering work to do to make that happen. I've driven almost every Elise variant over the years. 118 BHP K-Series, the one that everyone talks about head gasket failures with, I've driven those extensively. I had a Series 2 Elise with one of those in it that I built into a cup car. All the way through to supercharged Exiges, I've driven all of them. I think the sweet spot for that chassis is around 180 to 200 brake horsepower. That for me is where it feels most alive, most enjoyable. There's people out there, HP Automotive, if you want to go and watch that tech talk about Elises, you can go and do that. Dan builds 300 brake horsepower, normally aspirated cars. It's way beyond where I want this car to be. I want this to be narrow, tired, light, flickable sports car still with about 200 horsepower in the back. So if I was to think about whether I want it to be a torque monster or a rev car, I want it to be more torquey than I do fully revved out. So knowing that little bit of information, mate, where would you start guiding me in terms of all of these kind of this packaging
to use to start with.
What base, where, and but that can
just
be
want to use like a standard 911 engine without going too bonkers. Well, an SC with the last spec engine was 220 horsepower, but that is more revvy, but without it being like a 3.2 Carrera has got more torque than an SC. They're the same engine essentially, but the crank is different in a 3.2. It's got the same diameter, barrels and pistons. Yeah, up to you. But yeah, 220 SC, you could, and it'd be reliable as well. If you're going to start putting things on carbs, obviously you've got to drive it.
Yeah.
Because the best one in the world is still going to like oil the plugs up in traffic around town. If you're going to drive through town, you know.
I mean, the intent for this car is not for it to be it's either a single seat. You can, if you're watching this and you're potentially thinking about ordering one, you can have it left-hand drive, right-hand drive, or single seat central position. So,
would you want to do something different with like the engine though? So it's not like a standard.
Yeah,
engine.
Ideally. I mean,
the inlet system different.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, same as you, right? This I think is beautiful. You don't forget the back half of this car is a clamshell. You can lift the entire back up, so you'd be able to see everything. I want it to look and feel.
It probably needs some design done because the SC inlet system looks like a mess, really. Basically, it would be nice because of like what you're doing the project and keeping it really light. It would be nice to use the magnesium crankcase. And you could achieve that 218 horsepower figure fairly easily.
Yeah.
And reliably.
Yeah.
I think you could put some nice throttle bodies on it, talking about what we were talking about earlier, though, so that they look period, or like older rather than new, with like anodizing and peculiar colours, like you don't want some purple inlets, I assume.
Yeah, not preferably, no. Just for my personal taste.
For your personal taste, but anybody can have what they want. But yeah, I think like a period looking inlet system. With this sort of thing, or maybe a carbon fibre.
Carbon fibre, one of those, yeah.
And, magnesium crankcase.
Nice bit of kit.
That would go well. That would keep it a lot lighter.
Talk to me about heat management. It's one of the things I've always wondered about these, that once they're running, what is it like, mate? Managing the heat in these things? They can sit still for plenty of time.
We don't have too many problems, do we? The heat.
We're not still filming.
Yeah.
You can talk though.
With heat?
No.
No.
No, nothing like that.
They
no.
run really well, don't they? I mean, essentially they're oil and air cooled, don't they? Their fan is blowing all the air down across the barrels and through the heads and the barrels down and out the bottom.
Okay.
And on the later engines.
Some of you don't do stupid things with the air filters, which a lot of people do.
Yeah. Such as?
Well, they cut the ends of them off for some unknown reason.
So it's sucking in hot air.
So it's sucking in hot
air. Right, okay.
They leave bits of tin work missing or holes in the tin work, so then the fan is drawing up that hot air from the exhaust system, etc., from underneath the car, up through the fan and blowing hot air over the engine rather than drawing it in through the vent in the engine cover.
Later air-cooled engines have got squirters in the crankcase, so the oil's getting sprayed on the back of the piston as well, cooling it.
Right, okay.
Whereas this does not.
This is the level of nerdery that I'm interested in, right? So
the earlier stuff doesn't have that. What about in really, really hot countries? You get some bigger coolers. When you've been racing.
Places like, very hot countries, like on the only one I know of, on a 964, they put an extra oil cooler in the left-hand front wing. Extra engine oil cooler.
Yeah.
With a fan. Because it's got one in there already in the right hand side, and then stick another one in. But that's only for really hot clients, and I'm not sure, places I don't know, Malaysia, Japan, perhaps some places in Japan.
What about when you're doing.
But pre to that, they didn't do anything.
On the race cars, just run big, big coolers, right? You've got a lot of power.
Interesting. So one of the things that the Elise chassis has that this doesn't is it's completely flat floored underneath. Massive under tray to go across the hole underneath of the car. Whereas obviously what you've got is air being pushed down across the engine and out through the bottom, and it's exiting out at the bottom of the car.
Well, you've got to get that hot air out somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah,
This is where the engineering comes into it. Is that it's you can the idea of like cool that's physically doable. You can, you know, the dimensions work. You can put it in, but actually, as soon as you start thinking about all this stuff, if these things aren't designed to work together, you end up in a situation where you've got to, as an engineer, figure out model stuff, test stuff, and it's only once you've died out all of those niggles that you're at the point where you've got a working thing. So.
Yeah, but I mean, tricky. A 964, for argument's sake, it's got a big under tray underneath the engine.
Mm, okay.
It's got vents in it, obviously, in part of that under tray to let the hot air out. So you'll have to do something on the lines of that, because that works.
Yeah, okay.
You don't have any problems with overheating.
So it sounds like something similar to that, and start putting some temp sensors all around the place, running and doing some testing with it, and then extracting the data out and figuring out whether it's within the window.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Got a 964 here, you can have a look at it if you want.
Yes. Good. I think we're pretty much there, mate.
I think you've covered everything.
I think we've covered everything, yeah. Cool. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. And thank you for your introduction and additions. I much appreciate that. So, yeah, if you've got anything you want to ask Chris or the Rightune guys, you can get in touch. And it's Rightune on Instagram. Is there any other handle? Any other?
Rightune.
Yeah.
Facebook, Rightune911.
Yeah.
1T.
One T, not two T's. Well, hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thanks very much for watching. And if you want to leave any comments, if you want to know more about the Ram 550, if you want to know any more about Chris's car or his dad's car or anything they do, get in touch. And I'll see you next time. Take care for now.
Cheers.
Bye for now. Cool. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Chris is such a legend, right? He's a big, lovable teddy bear of a guy. He comes up to me if I see him at shows or wherever now, and it's always big hugs and kind of really. And then that's a big part of what Rengineering stands for. It's not just, you know, I'm plumbing away in the background trying to make the stuff happen, but actually it's not just me. It's all those people that have been partnering and supporting and kind of building Rengineering for what it is and what it will be in the future as well. So I hope you really enjoyed the episode. I hope you're doing well. If you get an opportunity to go out for a drive, the weather's starting to turn a bit crappy in the UK, but if you're elsewhere in the world, then go out and get yourself out into the mountains. And if you're in the UK, there's got to be some of those good days left, right? So and if you can't do that, then go and hang out with your mates, talk about cars, talk about Rengineering. And if you like this episode, do make sure you like, subscribe, tag your friends. If you're watching or listening to this on any podcast streaming service, please do stick some comments in. What do you want to know from Chris? Is there anything we missed in terms of air-cooled engines you'd like to know more about? And I will see you back next time. Take care for now. Bye-bye.
You can go, but just go around the back.
Or do it all now.
Just do it now.
Yeah.
No, because we might be here for like
45
hour.
Minutes, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Let me get the manual, come down.
Do what you need to do, my friend. Yeah, absolutely. This is what it's like.